From theunce.com, this is The Unce Podcast. Featuring artist interviews, unreleased tracks, and previews of the biggest events in electronic music. Available every week at theunce.com. Hello and welcome to The Unce Podcast. I'm your host, Anand Harsh. I've got a tremendously special hour-long episode for you today. My guest is famed UK producer Ott. For more than a decade, well, more than three decades, he's been paving his own way in the music industry. You'd have to go back to the 80s to find him playing in jazz fusion bands, and then move into the 90s to track his work as a mixing engineer and producer, working with huge acts on big commercial projects, and burning out on pop music in the eternal struggle between Coke and Pepsi. Ott went on to join forces with his buddy Simon Possford, crafting his own brand of psychedelic down-tempo electronic music, and releasing his debut album Blumenkraft and 2008's follow-up Skylon via Possford's Twisted Records. Following 2011's Mir, Ott got the idea to assemble some of his old studio buddies and friends from his teenage garage band into a full live act. In October, Ott and the All-Seeing Eye will embark on a massive U.S. tour spanning the coast and bringing all three of Ott's studio records to the stage in a completely new and totally live way. We'll talk all about that and dig into Ott's fascinating life in a minute, but first, we announced today the Unce Indian Bass Tour featuring Ill Gates and RD hitting the bottleneck in Lawrence, Kansas, People's Court in Des Moines, Iowa, 2720 Cherokee in St. Louis, the 4th annual Mojo Stock Festival in Indianapolis, and The Limit in Nashville, Tennessee, July 25th through the 29th. There's going to be special guests at all the stops, and we're going to give you a chance to win tickets next week. It's the Unce.com's inaugural indie and bass tour with Ill Gates and RD. More details at the Unce.com. All right, let's get to the interview. The big news, of course, that has been filtering throughout the American psychedelic and electronic scene is that you have assembled a full live band, yeah. In the All-Seeing Eye, which will be touring the States in October. And, you know, for someone who started off in bands and participated in numerous collaborations with other producers, I have to assume going out and playing your tunes with a full live band has been a dream of yours.
Kind of. I did it years and years and years ago and swore blind I'd never do it ever again. Because it's with me, I'm just dragging one fragile ego around the planet. But as soon as you start adding in other people, you don't just get the sum total of all the people involved. You get it's compounded by their interactions with each other.
And the monsters come out after 3 weeks in a bus.
Yeah. I mean, it's a high-pressure situation. There's kind of a lot hanging on it as well. You know, getting up and looking a dick in front of 1,000 people is a big deal.
Absolutely.
So the pressure to be good is kind of there. But actually, the guys that I'm working with, I wouldn't be doing this with just anybody. They're all people I know well, and they're all people that I know can do what I need them to do. But they're all kind of personalities involved. They're all very complementary. There is no raging battle of egos, apart from the fact that it's a benign dictatorship with me at the top.
Right, right. Well, you can say that, then.
It's my name on the flyer.
That's true.
No, I wouldn't be doing this with anybody. It's not like a, right, I want to put a band together, and then I found people. Mm-hmm. I realized I knew three people that would be really good fun to tour with, and asked them all about it, and luckily they all said yes.
Now, obviously, when you're producing, you have limitless variables at your fingertips, and you don't really hold back when you're crafting your rather lush soundscapes. Has that posed a challenge to you when it comes to arranging those big tunes for organic instruments?
No, I'm very fortunate in that. I mean, the drums, I like my drums to be kind of organic. I don't really go for glitchy electronic sounds. I like my drums to sound kind of woody. And I'm a frustrated drummer myself. The first instrument I ever played was drums. And when I'm programming drums, I'm actually programming what I'd like to hear myself actually play.
Yeah.
So my drum parts actually translate over to Matt, the drummer. He sort of, it sounds like mine, but better, actually.
Right.
Much more powerful and much more alive, but he manages to capture the grooves. And I'm also really fortunate in that Chris, the bass player, who I've released music with under the name of Umbeloid, he makes himself sound like a synth, the way he plays and
okay.
the lines that he chooses. I originally sort of pinned him to a wall by the throat and said, right, you play my notes and nothing else. And he kind of went, yeah, okay. He started playing my songs and it immediately sounded like he was playing in a straitjacket. And so I sort of, actually I shouldn't have said that, just play what you think, and sort of let him, turned him loose on everything. And he's managed to improve every single one so far.
That's perfect.
Again, it sounds like me, but more so. They're both pretty versatile as a rhythm section. They play, I've known them for 30 odd years. I think we played together in our first band when we were teenagers.
Tell me about that first band. What were you? Were you emulating?
It was garbage. Fucking awful. But we were 17. You know, we didn't really know. And it was the 80s. It was the late 80s. So we were surrounded by it was a terrible, terrible time for music. And we were just doing it for the pleasure of it. Really, didn't really give much thought to credibility or anything. But we enjoyed playing together.
Did you aim more towards Devo, more electronic or bizarre? Was it straight up like Smith's rock?
No. We weren't nearly as cool as that. We were the uncoolest band you ever heard. What were we listening to at the time? It was Level 42. Have you heard of them?
Interesting. No.
They're an English sort of jazz funk band.
Okay.
That were really massively popular over here, but probably nothing else. You know, nobody else in the entire world has ever heard of them. No, it was very undistinguished. We were just kind of, it's very difficult to describe, but no, it was never going to get anywhere. It was just a load of teenagers sort of playing together.
Sure.
But you know, we enjoyed the I enjoyed the process of playing together in our rehearsal room much more than doing gigs and stuff. I wasn't really in it for that. I was the keyboard player and I was terrible. I was awful. Because in those days you had to play everything. You couldn't just get a laptop to play it for you.
And loop it endlessly.
Yeah, and all that. We didn't have all the tools that we have today. I just had a really bad, cheesy old synth that I used to sort of program really badly and play even worse.
Is that what led you to studio work and engineering then, that sort of drive to take your sound and make it bigger and fuller?
I kind of realized I was never going to be a musician as such. I was never going to be an instrumentalist. I don't possess the physical dexterity or the patience to learn an instrument. Mm-hmm. So I'm a frustrated drummer, I'm a frustrated bass player, I'm a frustrated keyboard player, but I'm no longer frustrated because owning a computer enables me to record as if I can play all these instruments really well.
Absolutely.
And I can give the impression that I can play instruments very well. If you sit me in front of a piano and ask me to play you something, I'm kind of stumped. I can't really do very much, but if you give me 45 minutes with the laptop and the right software, I can program a piano part that makes it sound like I can play really well.
Do you regret then coming into your own during the 80s versus now, when as a teenager, instead of a guitar or drums, you're given a laptop with all these billions and billions of synths?
My regret is that I didn't get into LSD and ecstasy 5 years before I did. Because the end of the 80s was the acid, in Britain anyway, was the acid house boom.
Sure.
And while we were sort of purveying our dreadful sort of guitar, bass and drums sort of jazz, funk influenced rock, everyone else was necking loads of pills and going out and dancing in warehouses and fields.
But were you into that? Did that spark your interest at all?
No, it just sounded like a load of repetitive squonking noises. It didn't do anything for me whatsoever. I was into the Smiths and Julian Cope and people like that, sort of very angsty, emo kind of rock.
Adrift in Hilbert Space from Ott's 2011 album, Mir.
What was some of the first electronic music that maybe made you think, okay, I could do something somewhat in this area?
Well, at the end of the beginning of the 80s in Britain, there was a huge electronic music boom. There was Depeche Mode and Orchestral Manoeuvres in the Dark and Human League and Gary Numan and all that. There was this enormous boom in electronic music, and I was right there. That was all I wanted to listen to, was electronic music. And my mum was into Kraftwerk and stuff like that from the 70s and before. So I was into the whole electronics thing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But in the middle of the 80s, it suddenly went very, very uncool. And
yeah,
people stopped being into it, and I stopped being into it, and went off into other things. And also, it wasn't really satisfying to be in a band with three monosynths.
Right,
you couldn't make a great big noise. It was much more fun being in a band with a bass player and a drummer and a guitar player. And it was, like I say, well, I wasn't really interested in the making of records or all the gigs or touring or anything like that. I just like getting together and playing. I managed to get 180 degrees out of sync with music fashions. So when everyone else was into guitars and drums, I was into synths and stuff. And it was kind of, I was out of step with the fashion. And then when it flipped the other way and everyone started getting into house music and techno and acid house and stuff like that, I formed a band with drums and bass and was out of fashion again, was completely the wrong way around. And kind of, I could see the acid house thing building underneath what we were doing. And I knew we were hopelessly out of step with what was going on, but it didn't resonate with me. The whole repetitive beats thing I wasn't feeling it.
And to this day, I imagine the same is true.
No, I don't. There's not much for me in house music. There's not much for me in techno, really. There's not much for me in... I like drum and bass. I like... There are certain grooves that do it for me, but the repetitive four on the floor four thing doesn't do it for me at all.
I wonder if that's because, you know, as your first instrument was the drums, you were looking for something a little bit more.
Exactly.
Because the drums are sort of left in the dust with four on the floor.
Yeah, it's almost like someone's left the metronome on. That repetitive kick drum thing it sucks all the groove out of anything for me. As soon as that comes in, my interest is almost instantly switched off. I don't know why. Although on occasion I've gone out and taken loads of drugs and listened to it incredibly loud, and I get it. I understand why people are into it.
Sure.
But that's not where I am most of the time. So I'm kind of, it just leaves me a bit cold. It's been done. That sound has been made so many times. Anything it's going to say has been said now, I think. It's never grabbed me.
using the fruits of Babylon, so to speak, to build up any kind of organization.
The fruits of Babylon. Babylon will have no fruits. Exodus. Movement of your people.
Signals from Bob from Ott's 2008 album Skylon. We followed that up with a new one from Nadis Warriors, their remix of Bob Marley's Exodus. They'll be joining Ott and the All-Seeing Eye on select dates this October.
How did you get behind a console? Did you go to school for recording engineering or mixing?
No. I just bullshitted my way in.
There you go.
When that band split up, I decided I didn't want to be in a band anymore because I was never going to make it as a musician. So I decided to what more interested me was the times we went into recording studios to record demos. And I'd watch the engineer and think, you've got the best job in the world because you've got an entire universe of sound at your fingertips. And sonically, it's like being God, really. You can conjure up thunderbolts. You can basically shape the universe, the sonic universe, in any way you want, if you've got the skill, if you can command the equipment, you can do pretty much anything you like. And that really was interesting. There's only so much you can do with a guitar,
right?
Apart from impress girls. Drums, there's a lot of packing up and setting up and moving them around, and you can't get in a house.
Right.
Many people like listening to a drummer practicing. Synths were interesting, but not on their own. I don't listen to anything that's exclusively electronic. I like to have something organic in there to sort of offset it. And so just making music out of electronics didn't really interest me. And it seemed to be that the best job in the world was a sound engineer in a studio. And so I didn't have the patience to go to college and learn it. And my instinct told me, intuitively, I realized that it's not something you can go to college and learn. All you're ever going to learn in a college is a sanitized version, a theoretical version of what it is to be a sound engineer. So I just decided to put an advert in the local paper, like the local Craigslist thing, and engineer available, will work for free, you pay for the studio time. And I got a couple of takers for it.
Interesting.
And went up and did a bit of recording. And I didn't have before that, I had very limited experience in a studio. The band that I was in that subsequently split up, we got given a load of studio time by a man that wanted to be our manager, put a bit of money into the band. He thought we sounded great. So he paid for us to go into a really expensive studio and record a demo one weekend with an engineer called John Burns, who used to work for Decca Records in the 60s and EMI in the 70s. And he'd worked with just about everyone, David Bowie and Roxy Music and all of these people. He very, very experienced, and he recorded us. And it was a revelation watching him work. He was kind of, it all seemed very effortless, but it was all incredibly proficient. And I suppose he was in his 50s at the time, and he'd been doing it for so long that it was second nature to him. But I watched him very closely what he did and was really impressed by it, and sort of decided then that's what I wanted to do. So we got the recording that he made for us, and we went back and listened to it, and we thought, yeah, it's very proficient, it's very good, but it's a bit clean, it's a bit technically it's it's very impressive, but we wanted to sound a little bit more rougher edged. And so I said to the band, you give me some money, I'll rent a cheap studio, I'll take the tape up and remix it. So they all agreed. And this was my first taste of being an engineer. I booked this cheap studio in London. I took the tape up. I got in there and realized I didn't have the faintest clue what I was doing. I couldn't mixing desk. I couldn't work the tape machine. I couldn't even find the volume knob for the speakers. And there was the young guy, the young intern there, was just showing me how to do everything. He showed me how to put the tape on the machine, and he showed me how to get the faders up, and he showed me how to apply effects to things. And when I thought I got the hang of it, I sort of thanks very much and sent him away. And I spent the next eight hours making a mess. Awful, awful mix. And at the end of it, I listened back and was thoroughly disheartened. It was obvious I had no natural aptitude for this. It was obviously way more complicated than I thought it was. You didn't just turn things up and down and put reverb on them. So I sort of forlornly took the tape off the machine, put it into my bag and went to leave. And on the way out of the studio, the owner of the studio, a fella called Von, he sort of collared me in the corridor and said, are you an engineer? And I said, had a split second to sort of decide what to tell him, and for some reason I said yes,
of course I am.
Yeah, of course. And he said, great, we're looking for engineers, come into the office and play me what you were doing last night.
Oh no,
those shit or bust moments. It was obviously, you know, there was obviously an opportunity here, and I had to make the most of it. So I went into his office and gave him the cassette of the mix that John Burns did. And he was very impressed.
As he should be.
It sounded amazing on his office hi-fi, and he stood there absolutely amazed. You did this in my studio? Yeah.
Oh, boy.
And so he gave me a job on the spot and gave me my first session 3 days later. And so I had to learn to be a sound engineer in 3 days by reading books.
Do I dare ask you how that first session went?
Well, I turned up at the studio at 5 to midnight before the session, and these three guys were waiting with their drums and their bass and their guitars. And spookily, they'd played in a band together 25 years earlier when they were teenagers, and they'd split up and they'd lost contact with each other, and one had gone to New Zealand and one had gone to Hawaii and one was living in London, and they'd managed to get in contact with each other. This was in about 1991, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They got back in contact with each other, decided to have a reunion in London. And hey, wouldn't it be fun if we booked a studio and got our instruments and played all our old songs? And so they were terrible. They hadn't met each other in 25 years. They stopped playing.
Right.
And they brought in all their equipment and their drums and their guitars. And they brought in 2 crates of beer and 2 bottles of vodka and a bottle of tequila and some schnapps and various mixers and stuff. And I'm in the studio setting all their equipment up, and they're in the lounge getting absolutely obliterated.
So they may not even realize how green you are as an engineer.
Didn't have a clue.
That's a perfect setup for you then.
Yeah, absolutely. And they just proceeded to get so blind drunk that they all fell asleep on the floor of the lounge and never made people know. Had the best party of their lives, and they didn't play a single note, and I got paid £100 for it.
Well, why wouldn't you want to be an engineer after that?
Well, I thought this has got to be the best job in the world. I broke their equipment down, sent them on their way. And I worked pretty solidly for about the next 5 years. I worked every day. And because I was working in a cheap studio and I was the new guy, I got all the terrible bands that no one else wanted to do.
Yeah.
And they knew they were terrible, and they didn't have very high expectations of their recordings, which was good because neither did I.
Low expectations, you can always surpass them. That's the great thing.
And I quickly realized that if you can fake it, you can make it. And if you tell someone you're an engineer, I invented 5 years commercial experience straight away. And if you walk into a studio and tell people you're the engineer, they'll believe you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They just assume you know how all this shit works, because nobody would walk into a studio and bullshit to that extent, would they?
No, of course not.
Nobody would be that stupid. And so over the next 5 years, inadvertently, I became quite good at it, working I couldn't get enough of it. It was, he had me working, I'd work 3 days without sleep and then fall asleep in the maintenance cupboard on top of a rolled up carpet.
Wow.
Get 4 hours sleep, come out and do it all over again, because I was 20 and I had unlimited energy.
With Solstice from the Hallucinogen in Dub album on Simon Possford's Twisted Records.
Speaking of Roxy music, during that time, you actually got the chance to work with Brian Eno. I imagine that had to be a masterclass all in itself.
In a way, it was. That was much later on. That was about 97. I kind of knew what I was doing by then. Mm-hmm. And he was producing a band called James.
Oh, okay. Laid was their big one, right?
Yeah. And I think he did that.
Okay.
And I got to know the guitar player in James also worked with Simon Possford and Youth on a project called Celtic Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd been working on that for a while, and I got asked to mix a few of the tracks on it. And so I mixed a few of the tracks, and then through that met Saul, the guitar player from James.
Mm-hmm.
He liked what I did on that, and when James came to do some demos, they sort of phoned me up and got me up to do some recording, and we all got on, and the demos worked really well. And then one Monday morning, they were supposed to be making a single with a producer called, I can't remember his name now, he was Gary Langan. He was an engineer for Trevor Horn and Art of Noise, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
And he was supposed to be producing their single, and because they were a bit of a handful. I can't really say much more than that, but there were several several problems of excess going on within the band, and none of them particularly compatible. And the singer was a very straight edge, clean living Buddhist kind of who didn't really get on with it. Well, it was a fairly explosive situation, and he found himself in the middle of this total war zone and couldn't deal with it. And on the Monday morning, just got up and said, fuck this, don't need it, going home, bye guys. And so they found themselves with 15 grand's worth of studio booked and no producer. And so they're all sitting around the breakfast table going, what are we going to do? And Saul put his hand up and went, I know a guy. They phoned me up and I came down and produced a single for them, which, you know, they really liked, and it did quite well. And when it came around to doing their next album, Brian Eno was producing their album. And they asked me to come down and just get involved and do some stuff. And so I sort of turned up with my programming rig and set myself up in one of the rooms. This was at Psalm Hook End, Henley on Thames. It's one of Trevor Horn's places. It used to be David Gilmour from Pink Floyd's private home.
Oh, wow.
The beautiful studio in it, massive, great big manor house in loads of hundreds of acres of grounds and beautiful studio. But it's now Trevor Horn bought it from him and was using it as a commercial studio. And so it was James and me and Eno in there for about 3 months, I suppose.
In David Gilmour's old house with all that history surrounding
it. It was like, this is the pinnacle now. I was making great money. I was earning more money than in a day than I'd ever earned in a week. And the money was coming in, and I was working with, you know, proper bona fide famous people now. I kind of, you know, I I wasn't doing some crap band who'd saved up all their gig money and was paying for their recording. And this was the big league. This was like $1 million budget, and the producers getting hundreds of thousands, and the studio bills $25,000 a week. And
yeah,
you know, it was pretty amazing to be there. But actually, creatively, it wasn't the most fulfilling thing I ever did.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Really, all I learned from Brian Eno was that he's just a guy that wants to make a really good record, and that's it. He's got no magic wand.
Mm-hmm.
He's got no outstanding technical skill that makes you stand there going, wow, did you see what he just did?
Mm-hmm.
The thing that he's got is that when he walks into a room, everyone goes, fucking hell, it's Brian Eno. And everyone stops being a dick for half an hour.
Well, that's a magical power in itself then, isn't it?
In a recording studio, that's invaluable. So people want to know him. He, you know, he's worked with David Bowie and U2 and David Byrne and the Talking Heads, and he works with who he wants to work with. He picks and chooses his work. He doesn't have to be there, and he's worked with some really good people. So the last thing you want to do is sit in front of him and do something half-assed and lackluster.
Sure, just sure.
Brings up, but he also he's first in the morning. He's there at 8:30 with his rig set up, waiting to go. Very patiently waiting for everyone to come in. And he's the last out in the evening, and he's very conscientious about what he does. And he's really nice. He's a really nice guy, and you actually want to do good work for him. And he does know what he's on about. He knows how to get you to a good record, and he's not scared. He's not frightened of, God, what will people think of this?
Mm-hmm.
Thinks it's a good idea. Let's do it.
Right.
And he's got nothing to prove, and that's quite a lot in itself, because 99% of the music industry has a lot to prove. And
right.
behaves as if it has a lot to prove. And that's pretty much what I learned from Eno, was that he's just a guy trying to make a really good record and has nothing to prove. You know, he's not particularly gifted with a mixing desk. He's not particularly gifted with an instrument. He's got a rather nice voice. He's got a lovely singing voice. But that's it, really. People make quite a big deal about the Brian Eno thing. But... other than it being a really good name drop at a party.
Yeah, sure.
It's not, it wasn't the highlight. It hasn't been the highlight of my musical career to date. I had far more informative, mind-blowing, creative experiences with bands of 17-year-olds who'd scraped together 500 quid to make a record. And it was the first recording they'd ever made, and £500 was a lot to them at the time, and they really, really, really tried to make it as good as they could.
Absolutely.
And I did 500 of those bands, and it was, if I look back over my time as a sound engineer or a producer or whatever, that was the time that was most exciting to me, because it was just raw creativity. There wasn't all this music industry bullshit going on behind the scenes. It was them. A little envelope, a little brown envelope full of money, me in a cheap studio. And you had to make what you could of it. And that was the most exciting period for me, really. Actually, I found that the further up the greasy pole I got, the less I enjoyed it. Sitting in a studio in London with BT, Brian Transo.
Yeah.
Engineering for him, mixing a Pepsi commercial that he'd been commissioned to make. And it was one of the most soul-destroying weeks of my life. I was loads and loads of money working with some famous guy. And he's really good. He's a really lovely guy. And he's very...
Yeah, he is. Yeah.
Very talented and really knows what he's doing. But sitting in a studio with a guy making a Pepsi commercial for a week, that's like having your brain sucked out with a vacuum cleaner.
Is that what then pushed you towards your own, your solo material, going off and doing your own thing? These sessions, you know, you're slaving over other people's music, or even worse, some strictly commercial product. Is that what made you say, okay, I'm doing my own thing?
There was a moment during the BT session where he'd been taking on so much work that he had extraordinarily painful carpal tunnel syndrome. You know, like from using a mouse.
Yeah.
You know what carpal tunnel syndrome is?
Yeah, absolutely. Just repetitive stress injuries.
Exactly. And he was crippled. His right hand was just, he was in agony. He was trying to make music through this agony. And I'd hurt my back. And I had really bad sciatica, and it was mainly from sitting in swivel chairs with a bad posture at a mixing desk day in, day out.
Just hunched over all day long.
Industrial injuries, just both of us in excruciating pain trying to make art.
Yeah.
While the guy from Pepsi stands behind us and with a completely straight face starts giving a shit because there's loads of empty cans of Coke around on the because the soda machine in the studio just sells Coke. We're sitting there swinging Coke, making a Pepsi commercial. And the guy from Pepsi stood at the back of the room taking a really dim view of this.
Oh, man.
And just, I'm sitting there just thinking, what the fuck am I doing in here? I'm making more money than I've ever made, and I hate my life. I'm spending my entire life in 18-hour days in windowless, air-conditioned air-conditioned buildings. Okay, it's really cool to be sitting in front of a $500,000 SSL mixer and, you know, all the best outboard equipment you could possibly want, and we're sitting here wasting it on a fucking Pepsi commercial. What got me to this point? And that was it, really. That was it for me. I decided that I wanted out of it, and I was probably better off on the other side of the glass.
Yeah,
and I've had a vague resentment for the way the credits were always sort of distributed when a record was made, because engineers do tend to get shit on quite a lot.
Right,
a lot. There's a lot of very, very creative people working in studios that are getting paid by the hour, and there's a lot of really uncreative pop stars whose records are being made by really creative people who get paid by the hour, and they don't really get the credit they deserve. And just slimy producers stealing mix credits, and you know, you'll spend 18 hours, maybe 36 hours mixing a track, and then when it comes out you get a copy of the record and it will say mixed by Big Shot producer because he can do that. And that happened to me quite a few times, people just taking the credit for your work. And it happened once too often, and I just thought, I'm sick of this. And then my back got really bad, and I couldn't work. I had to take 2 years off work just to lay on my front and go, ouch. And so that was the time when I decided, okay, I'm not going to get back into working on other people's music. Got my studio down to ground level. I literally took everything off the stands, put it all on the floor in a semicircle around me, because I couldn't stand, I couldn't sit, and I couldn't lay. All I could do was lay on my front.
Oh, wow.
Because my sciatic nerve was trapped in my pelvis, and I had extraordinarily painful back pain, and which was untreatable with painkillers, and all I could do was lay on my front in pain. But there was one position I could get into that didn't hurt, and so I sort of propped myself up in this position on cushions and pillows and put all my equipment around me and just sat there doodling away, just making little bits of music. And most of those are what turned into my first album, Blumencraft.
Did you have a real concept of what Blumenkraft would be when you were starting on this? Did you think, okay, I'm going to sort of peer into the world of psychedelia, bring a little of the dance aesthetic into it? Did you really have an idea of what you wanted to do, or was this completely pulling from the blue?
Quite the opposite. I'd been working to a brief for 10 years, and it was that I found incredibly stifling, working to, right, this, I'm going to set out to do this. And the whole point when I started making my own music was I was just going to do it as intuitively as possible, not try and make music for anybody, not try and fit it to any brief, just lie there and see what comes out and just do it purely for me. I wasn't ever going to play it to anybody. The whole point was it was just going to be for me. Mm-hmm. I spent 10 years making music for other people and feeling more and more sort of violated as time went on. And so decided I wasn't going to do it for anybody else, just do it for me, and just sat and did a load of little sonic experiments. And I suppose in my head what I was trying to create was the perfect soundtrack to an English summer outdoor festival, because they got a very particular flavor. I discovered festivals in the 90s. I went to Glastonbury in 1991, I think it was, the first time, and just fell in love with the whole thing, the whole deal with festivals. Just found my place, found my people, if you like. So decided to, that was the thing that gave me the most motivation, was creating a soundtrack, a perfect soundtrack to an outdoor English festival. So that's what I was sitting, if I had a brief, that's what it was. And so that's what Blumenkraft became. But I wasn't intending to play it to anybody. And one day, Simon Posford, Spongle Hallucinogen, he used to live down the road from me. We're good friends. And he just popped round one day just to see how I was. And we'd sit and drink tea and whatever. And I had one of my tracks on a CD with a load of other tracks. And it came on while I was out of the room. And he shouted from the other room, "What's this?" And I said, "Oh, it's just something I've been playing around with." And he said, "It's brilliant. I want to release it." So that turned out to be the track Summer Settler, which is on Blue.
Okay.
And he put it out on a Twisted compilation, and I don't think I got any money for it. I might have got 500 quid for it or something. I don't know, but it was just did it for the fun of it, and people really liked it. And so I said, "Well, I've got a load more of that if you want it." And I sort of wrote a couple more tracks, and it turned into that album. But in the meantime, I'd done Hallucinogen in Dub as well, the remixes of all his Hallucinogen trance tracks.
Right. It's funny. I mean, he's got such a similar background to yours, you know, working in studios and sort of breaking out and doing his own stuff. I wonder how what he has done has influenced your own sound, and especially since, you know, there's a lot of years between Blumenkraft and Skylon and Mir, and I wonder how your own evolution, your own sonic evolution, has either mirrored what's going on in England or in the States, or has been like when you were younger, working 180 degrees as to what's cool or in or not. You know, when everyone's playing instruments, you're listening to electronic music, and then vice versa. I wonder how your own evolution of sound has followed a certain trajectory, either in line with everything else or completely counter to that.
I think I learned to completely disregard everything else. A lot of people will ask me about sort of my contemporaries and my, you know, other people that are operating in a similar kind of sphere to me. And I always have to sort of confess ignorance. I don't really listen to what's going on around me. I don't listen to contemporary electronic music. I think people imagine me sitting at home in my sort of smoking jacket and slippers listening to Spongle of an evening. and that isn't how it is. I'm more likely to be listening to BBC Radio 4 or which is, you know, you'll have to listen to it. I can't describe it. I'm probably going to be listening to some kind of classical station or just silence, or maybe some ska from the late 1950s and 60s, or maybe some obscure English prog rock band from the early 70s, or I'm not generally listening to what's going on around me. Deliberately, because I don't really want to be influenced by what my contemporaries are doing.
Right.
And so I try to keep myself as sterile as possible. I do hear stuff when I'm at shows. I can't help it. I try not to be there when the other bands are on, and I have my earplugs in all the time, two pairs sometimes. I'm consciously trying to keep new music out of my head, contemporary music out of my head. I'll listen to new old music, anything before about 1980 I'm probably interested in. I just got into the Cars recently.
Oh, brilliant.
All that kind of new wave stuff from the end of the 70s, the Cars and Blondie and Talking Heads and bands like that, I had a little bit of a craze on. I like periods of music. I don't really tend to get into any one band or any one style, but I like periods of music. And at the moment,
that's an interesting approach.
78 to 82 in America and Britain. That was a really good time for music in your country.
Absolutely.
Devo and people like that. It went very colorful and it went very experimental and kind of, it was sort of coincided with the birth of MTV, and that really helped. But I don't, I'm not trying to mine any seam, and I'm not trying to conform to any genre or be part of any kind of movement or bandwagon or party. What fascinates me is what I come up with in a total vacuum and how it relates to other people. I heard a lot of dubstep in the last 3 years. I've heard a lot of dubstep.
I'm sure you have.
And so couldn't help being influenced by what I remembered it sound like, and people have sort of remarked on the dubstep sections in my last album, which I can't really hear because I don't think it sounds anything like it. I can hear where I've been influenced by it, but as usual, I've got it wrong.
To your credit, then, especially on Mir.
If I were to sit down and try and make a house record, I'd get it completely wrong because I always do. If ever I try to mimic a style, I fuck it up. I'm no good at that kind of thing, but I do my interpretation of it.
It would always have the art thumbprint on it.
It has to please me. That's the only criteria I apply. That's the only criterion I apply to anything I do, is that it has to set my endorphins pinging. If it makes my brain chemicals go all weird and fluttery, then it's working for me. And I mean, it's probable that if it makes my endorphins go ping, it'll make other people's endorphins go ping too.
There's a good possibility, absolutely.
And so that's how it works. And people whose endorphins are wired like mine tend to appreciate the same sounds and the same dynamics and the same environments.
On that tip, you've got a few upcoming solo festival dates here in the U.S., Narnia, Beloved, Rootwire. Any surprises in store for the American fans, new tunes, or perhaps previews of the Seeing Eye tour?
No, it won't be anything to do with the All Seeing Eye tour, because that's a completely different thing, and it's proving to be so unwieldy. Just getting myself together is just feels like a picnic compared to this. Just the amount of things I'm having to, the logistics of taking a band out. I if I thought this through, I'd never have started it.
You've never done it. That's great.
When I
that's
tour, sick. It's just me, my flight case, and a suitcase full of underpants, and that's it, and a toothbrush, and I get on a plane, I turn up in a town, I go to a hotel, I go to a venue, I play a show, I go to a hotel, I go to an airport, I go to the next town, and I just do that, and it's so beautifully simple and uncomplicated. And all of a sudden I'm having to hire fucking tour buses and organize work visas for people and sound men and production managers and road managers and drivers and just... The amount of money I'm having to shell out up front. And I'm probably just about going to break even on the first tour. If that, it might even cost me to do it. It's such a ridiculous endeavor. And the other guys in the band, they have commitments. They sort of, you know, they do things to bring in the rent and the mortgage and whatever. They've got families and they've got kids. And it's just such a ridiculously colossal endeavor. I do keep waking up sweating, wondering what the hell I'm doing. And then we get together and play, and it's, yeah, I get it now. And it does sound brilliant, and it really is exciting to do. And if it goes off like I imagine it in my head, when I'm lying there at night trying to make myself go to sleep, I kind of imagine how brilliant it's going to be playing at the Boulder Theatre or the Aggie or somewhere like that. And it's just going to be brilliant, and people are going to love it. And I think, yeah, okay, that's why I'm doing it. But in my darker moments, I just imagine this fist fight at the side of the interstate. and people sort of never speaking to each other ever again, and just seething resentments and ego battles and stuff. And I've just got to make sure that Anyone that tries to usurp my position as alpha male gets slapped down immediately.
As much as this is putting you in a cold sweat thinking about it, fans are absolutely salivating over it. So hopefully you'll be able to put the negativity aside and enjoy the moment, not having to worry about drivers and hotels and making sure everybody gets paid.
When I stop having to sign checks, maybe I'll calm down.
Yeah, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for being on the UNS podcast.
My pleasure.
Closed out today's episode with The Aubergine of the Sun from Ott's 2011 release, Mir. In the last break, you heard Splitting an Atom from Ott's debut album, Blumenkraft. Special thanks for this week's episode go to Chris Richards and Frank Green with Autonomous Music, and of course, my guest, Ott. You can see him at Narnia, Beloved, Rootwire, and Bella Terra festivals in August, and then for the entire month of October, he'll be touring as Ott and the All-Seeing Eye, a full live band playing songs from all three of his albums, with special guests Govinda, Papadozio, and the Nadi's Warriors at places like the Bottom Lounge in Chicago, Trees in Dallas, the Boulder Theater in Boulder, Colorado, the Aggie in Fort Collins, and so many more. Please visit theunce.com/Ott to get a complete list of dates. Remember, theunce.com is presenting the Indian Bass Tour with Ill Gates and RD in a little less than 2 weeks, July 25th through the 29th, at select spots across the Midwest. Please visit theunce.com for more details. We'll be giving away tickets all next week. Please visit theunce.com for news, artist profiles, and tour dates from across the electronic music spectrum. And go ahead and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Write us a review, tell us what you think of the show. If you have any questions, comments, or complaints about the program, you'd like to be a guest on the UNS podcast, or you'd like to sponsor an episode, contact me at anand@theunce.com. That's A-N-A-N-D at theunce.com. Join the conversation at the UNS podcast on Twitter. We'll catch you next week.